And good afternoon, it's Rod McClure here with our Monday afternoon book reading. And it's Easter Monday. I hope everybody had a lovely weekend, a lovely Easter. Spare a thought for the people coming back on the highway this afternoon. It's been chockers all day, actually. And I believe that a car caught fire on the Braidwood side of Bungendore. So there's been delays there. Hopefully that's been dealt with, and people are able to get home. And please drive safely. We really don't want fatalities or injuries for that matter. But before we go on with our reading of Nicholas Nickleby, first of all, a word from the people who helped to make our little station all it is.
Braidwood Community Bank, your local community bank supporting your local community. For friendly, helpful advice on general banking, investments, home loans, personal loans, retirement and superannuation and insurance, contact Braidwood Community Bank on 4842 1700, a proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Damn starter motor! I think it's finally given in. I'm miles from anywhere. What now? Hallelujah. That's right. Brendan and his team at Braidwood Auto Electrics have a fast mobile and on-site service. And I saved his number in my phone for that reason. Yeah, it's 4842 1008. Hi Brendan, it's Steve here. Yeah mate, that's starter motor. What? You can be here in 20 minutes? Great. See you then. Braidwood Auto Electrics, there for all your electrical needs. And he's a proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
Goulburn Workers Club is located in the heart of Goulburn CBD. There are three public bars, including a cocktail lounge boasting 20 different products on tap across the club, as well as full TAB and keno facilities. Enjoy Monday to Friday lunch specials for $10. Monday and Tuesday nights is half price steak or salmon. Wednesday nights is two roasts for the price of one. Thursday nights is $10 chicken schnitzel, and coffee and cake deals are available 7 days a week in the cafe. Goulburn Workers Club are proud to be a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And a big thank you to our sponsors who help our little station to operate as effectively as it does. Well, just a quick announcement too, actually. First of all, the Braidwood News Agency Colouring Competition. The winners were Isabel Watson and Bridie Gleeson. Congratulations to both young people. It's good to see them having the determination to go into a colouring in competition. Wonderful. And on Saturday the 13th of April between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m, everyone's invited to have a look at Araluen's hidden history. It's the opening of the Araluen History Trail and website. You can find out more by going all lowercase to the Araluen Valley, as one word, -history.com.au. Sounds like a wonderful day. And of course, on the 27th of April at the Araluen Federal Hall, there will be a Made in Araluen market. And I'm sure that that will be every bit as rewarding a thing to attend. Well, we've been reading Nicholas Nickleby by Charles Dickens. And we've reached a sort of a point where, if you recall, Miss Fanny Squeers has decided that Nicholas has actually fallen in love with her. Now, he hasn't, but she's big-noting herself, basically, to her friend Matilda, who, of course, has announced her engagement to a local miller's son. We continue on. It so fell out that Mrs. Squeers' journey to some distance to fetch three new boys and dun the relations of two old ones for the balance of a small amount was fixed that very afternoon for the next day but one, and on the next day but one Mrs. Squeers got up outside the coach as it stopped to change at Greta Bridge, taking with her a small bundle containing something in the bottle and some sandwiches, and carrying besides a large white topcoat to wear in the night time, with which baggage she went her way. Whenever such opportunities as these occurred, it was the Squeezer's custom to drive over to Market Town every evening on the pretense of urgent business and stop till 10 or 11 o'clock at a tavern that Mr. Squeers much affected. As the party was not in his way, therefore, but rather afforded a means of compromise with Miss Squeers, he readily yielded his full assent thereunto, and willingly communicated to Nicholas that he was expected to take his tea in the parlour that evening at 5 o'clock. To be sure, Miss Squeers was in a desperate flutter as the time approached, and to be sure, she was dressed out to the best advantage, with her hair — it had more than a tinge of red, and she wore it in a crop — curled in 5 distinct rows up to the very top of her head, and arranged dexterously over the doubtful eye, to say nothing of the blue sash which floated down her back, or the worked apron, or the long gloves, or the green gauze scarf worn over one shoulder and under the other, or any of the numerous devices which were to be as many arrows to the heart of Nicholas. She had scarcely completed these arrangements when, to her entire satisfaction, when the friend arrived with a whitey-brown parcel, flat and three-cornered, containing sundry small adornments which were to be put on upstairs, and which the friend put on, talking incessantly. When Miss Squeers had done the friend's hair, the friend did Miss Squeers' hair, throwing in some striking improvements in the way of ringlets down the neck, and then, when they were both touched up to their entire satisfaction, they went downstairs in full state, with the long gloves on, all ready for company.
Where is John, Tilda? Said Miss Squeers.
Oh, only gone home to clean himself, replied the friend. He'll be here by the time the tea's drawn.
Oh, I do so palpitate, observed Miss Squeers.
Oh, I know what it is, replied the friend.
I have not been used to it, you know, Tilda,
said Miss Squeers, applying her hand to the left side of her sash. Oh, you'll get the better of it, dear, rejoined the friend. While they were talking thus, the hungry servant brought in tea things, and soon afterwards somebody tapped at the room door.
Oh, there he is, cried Miss Squeers. Oh, Tilda!
Hush, said Tilda.
say, come in.
Oh, come in!
And in walked Nicholas. Good evening, said that young gentleman, all unconscious of his conquest. I understood from Mr. Squeers that...
Oh, yes, it's all right, interposed Miss Squeers. Father don't tea with us, but you won't mind that, I dare say.
This was said archly. Nicholas opened his eyes at this, but he turned the matter off very coolly, not caring particularly about anything just then, and went through the ceremony of introduction to the miller's daughter with so much grace that the young lady was lost in admiration.
"We're only waiting for one more gentleman," said Miss Squeers, taking off the teapot lid and looking in to see how the tea was getting on.
It was a matter of equal moment to Nicholas whether they were waiting for one gentleman or 20, so he received the intelligence with perfect unconcern, and, being out of spirits and not seeing any special reason why he should make himself agreeable, looked out of the window and sighed involuntarily. As luck would have it, Miss Squeers' friend was of a playful turn, and hearing Nicholas sigh, she took it into her head to rally the lovers on their lowness of spirits.
"But if it's caused by my being here," said the young lady, "don't mind me a bit, for I'm quite as bad. You may go on just as you would if you were alone." "Tilda," said Miss Squeers, colouring up to the top row of curls, "I am ashamed of you."
And here the two friends burst into a variety of giggles and glanced from time to time over the tops of their pocket handkerchiefs at Nicholas, who, from a state of unmixed astonishment, gradually fell into one of irrepressible laughter, occasioned partly by the bare notion of his being in love with Miss Squeers, and partly by the preposterous appearance and behaviour of the two girls. These two causes of merriment, taken together, struck him as being so keenly ridiculous that, despite his miserable condition, he laughed till he was thoroughly exhausted. "Well," thought Nicholas, "as I'm here and seem expected for some reason or other to be amiable, it's no use looking like a goose. I may as well accommodate myself to the company." We blush to tell it, but his youthful spirits and vivacity, getting for a time the better of his sad thoughts, he no sooner formed this resolution than he saluted Miss Squeers and the friend with great gallantry, and in drawing a chair to the tea-table, began to make himself more at home than in all probability an usher has ever done in his employer's house since ushers were first invented.
The ladies were in the full delight of this altered behaviour on the part of Mr. Nickleby when the expected swain arrived, with his hair very damp from recent washing and a clean shirt whereof the collar might have belonged to some giant ancestor, forming together with a white waistcoat of similar dimensions the chief ornament of his person. "Well, John," said Miss Matilda Price, which, by the by, was the name of the miller's daughter. "Weel," said John, with a grin that even the collar could not conceal. I beg your pardon," interposed Miss Squeers, hastening to do the honours. "Mr. Nickleby, Mr. John Bowdy. Yours to command, sir," replied Nicholas, making fearful ravages on the bread and butter. Your servant, sir," said John, who was something over 6 foot high, with a face and body rather above the due proportion than below it. Mr. Browdie was not a gentleman of great conversational powers, so he grinned twice more, and having now bestowed his customary mark of recognition on every person in company, grinned at nothing particular, and helped himself to food. "Oh, woman, how eh been she?" said Mr. Browdie with his mouth full. Miss Squeers nodded assent. Mr. Browdie gave a grin of special width as if he thought that really was something to laugh at, and went to work at the bread and butter with increased vigour. It was quite a sight to behold how he and Nicholas emptied the plate between them. "You ain't get bread and butter every night, I expect, mun," said the Browdie, after he had sat staring at Nicholas for a long time over the empty plate. Nicholas bit his lip and coloured, but affected not to hear the remark. "Ecod," said Mr. Browdie, laughing boisterously, "they didn't put too much in vintin'. You'll be now but skeen and bones if you stop here long enough. Ho, ho, ho!" "You are facetious, sir," said Nicholas scornfully. "Nay, dinna know," replied Browdie. "But t'or the teacher could he were learn, and he were he learnin'." The recollection of the last teacher's leanness seemed to afford Mr. Browdie the most exquisite delight, for he laughed until he found it necessary to apply his coat cuffs to his eyes. "I don't know whether your perceptions are quite keen enough, Mr. Browdie, to enable you to understand that your remarks are offensive," said Nicholas in a towering passion. "But if they are, have the goodness to—" "If you say another word, John," shrieked Miss Price, stopping her admirer's mouth as if he was about to interrupt, "only half a word, and I will never forgive you, or speak to you again." "Well, my lass, I didn't care about'n," said the corn factor, bestowing a hearty kiss on Miss Matilda. "Let us gang on. Let them gang on." It now became Miss Squeers' turn to intercede with Nicholas, which she did with many symptoms of alarm and horror. The effect of the double intercession was that he and John Browdie shook hands across the table with much gravity, and such was the imposing nature of the ceremonial that Miss Squeers was overcome and shed tears. "What's the matter, Fanny?" said Miss Price. "Nothing, Tilda," replied Miss Squeers, sobbing. "There never was any danger," said Miss Price. "Was there, Mr. Nickleby?"
"None at all," replied Nicholas. "Absurd."
"That's right," whispered Miss Price. "Say something kind to her, and she'll come round. Here, shall John and I go into the little kitchen and come back presently?"
"Not on any account,"
rejoined Nicholas, quite alarmed at the proposition. "What on earth should you do that for?" "Well," said Miss Price, beckoning him aside and speaking with some degree of contempt, "you are one to keep company."
"What do you mean?" said Nicholas. "I am not a one to keep company at all. Here, at all events, I can't make this out."
"No, nor I either," rejoined Miss Price. "But men are always fickle, and always were, and always will be. That I can make out very easily."
"Fickle?" cried Nicholas. "What do you suppose? You don't mean to say that you think—"
"Oh, I think nothing at all," retorted Miss Price pettishly. "Look at her, dressed so beautiful and looking so well, really almost handsome. I am ashamed at you."
"My dear girl, what have I got to do with her dressing beautifully or looking well?" inquired Nicholas.
"Come, don't call me a dear girl," said Miss Price, smiling a little low, for she was pretty, and a coquette too in her small way, and Nicholas was good-looking, and she supposed him the property of somebody else, which were all reasons why she should be gratified to think she had made an impression on him. "Or Fanny will be saying it's my fault. Come, we're going to have a game at cards. Pronouncing these last words aloud, she tripped away and rejoined the big Yorkshireman. This was wholly unintelligible to Nicholas, who had no other distinct impression on his mind at the moment than that Miss Squeers was an ordinary-looking girl and her friend, Miss Price, a pretty one. But he had no time to enlighten himself by reflection, for the hearth being by this time swept up, the candles snuffed, they sat to play speculation.
"There are only four of us, Tilda," said Miss Squeers, looking slyly at Nicholas. "So we better go partners, two against two."
"What do you say, Mr. Nickleby?" inquired Miss Price. "With all the pleasure in life," replied Nicholas, and so saying, quite unconscious of his heinous offence, he amalgamated into one common heap those portions of the Dothboy Hall card of terms which represented his own counters and those allotted to Miss Price respectively.
"Mr. Brodie," said Miss Squeers hysterically, "shall we make a bank against them?"
The Yorkshireman assented, apparently quite overwhelmed by the new usher's impudence, and Miss Squeers darted a spiteful look at her friend and giggled convulsively. The deal fell to Nicholas and the hand prospered. "We intend to win everything," said he.
"Well, Tilda has won something she didn't expect, I think. Haven't you, dear?" said Miss Squeers maliciously. "Oh, only a dozen and eight, love," replied Miss Price, affecting to take the question in a literal sense.
"How dull you are tonight," sneered Miss Squeers.
"Oh, no, indeed," replied Miss Price. "I am in excellent spirits. I was thinking you seemed out of sorts."
"Me?" cried Miss Squeers, biting her lips and trembling with very jealousy. "Oh, no."
"Well, that's well," remarked Miss Price. "Your hair's coming out of curl, dear."
"Never mind us. No, never mind me," tittered Miss Squeers. "You had better attend to your partner."
"Thank you for reminding her," said Nicholas. So she had.
The Yorkshireman flattened his nose once or twice, and with his clenched fist, as if to keep his hand in, till he had an opportunity of exercising it upon the features of some other gentleman, and Miss Squeers tossed her head with such indignation that the gust of wind raised by the multitudinous curls in motion nearly blew the candle out.
"Oh, I never had such luck, really," exclaimed coquettish Miss Price after another hand or two. "It's all along of you, Mr. Nickleby, I think. I should like to have you for a partner."
"Always."
"I wish you had."
You'll have a bad wife, though, if you always win at cards," said Miss Price.
"Not if your wish is gratified," replied Nicholas. "I am sure I shall have a good one in that case."
To see how Miss Squeers tossed her head and the corn factor flattened his nose while this conversation was carrying on, it would have been worth a small annuity to have beheld that, let alone Miss Price's evident joy at making them jealous and Nicholas Nickleby's happy unconsciousness of making anybody uncomfortable.
"We have all been talking to ourselves, it seems," said Nicholas, looking good-humouredly around the table as he took up the cards for a fresh deal.
"You do it so well," tittered Miss Squeers, "that it would be a pity to interrupt.
Wouldn't it, Mr. Browdie?"
"He he he he."
"Nay," said Nicholas, "we do it in default of having anybody else to talk to."
"We'll talk to you, you know, if you'll say anything," said Miss Price.
"Thank you, Tilda dear," retorted Miss Price majestically.
"Or you can talk to each other if you don't choose to talk to us," said Miss Price, rallying her dear friend.
"John, why don't you say something?"
"Say summat," repeated the Yorkshireman.
"Aye, and not sit there so silent and glum."
"Well then," said the Yorkshireman, striking the table heavily with his fist, "what I say is this. Dang my bones and body, if I can stand this any longer. Do you gang home, my wee? And you might ain't tonight, yon whipster. Look sharp out for a broken head next time he comes under my hand."
"Mercy on us, what's all this?" cried Miss Price in affected astonishment.
"Come home, tell him, come home," replied the Yorkshireman sternly,
and as he delivered the reply, Miss Squeers burst into a shower of tears, arising in part from desperate vexation and in part from an impotent desire to lacerate somebody's countenance with her fair fingernails. The state of things had been brought about by divers means and workings. Miss Squeers had brought it about by aspiring to the high state and condition of being matrimonially engaged without good grounds for so doing. Miss Price had brought it about by indulging in three motives of action. First, a desire to punish her friend for laying claim to a rivalship in dignity, having no good title. Secondly, the gratification of her own vanity in receiving the compliments of a smart young man. And thirdly, a wish to convince the corn factor of the great danger he ran in deferring the celebration of their expected nuptials. While Nicholas had brought it about by half an hour's gaiety and thoughtlessness, and a very sincere desire to avoid the imputation of inclining at all to Miss Squeers. So the means employed and the end produced were alike, the most natural in the world, for young ladies will look forward to being married and will jostle each other in the race to the altar and will avail themselves of all opportunities of displaying their own attractions to the best advantage, down to the very end of time, as they have done from its beginning.
"Why, and here's Fanny in tears now!" exclaimed Miss Price, as if in fresh amazement. "Whatever can be the matter?"
"Oh, you don't know, miss, of course, you don't know. Pray don't trouble yourself to inquire," said Miss Squeers, producing that change of countenance which children call making a face.
"Well, I'm sure," exclaimed Miss Price. "And who cares whether you are sure or not, ma'am," retorted Miss Squeers, making another face.
"You are monstrous polite, ma'am," said Miss Price.
"I shall not come to take lessons in the art, ma'am," retorted Miss Squeers.
"You needn't take the trouble to make yourself plainer than you are, ma'am, however," rejoined Miss Price, "because that's quite unnecessary."
Miss Squeers, in reply, turned very red, and thanked God that she hadn't got the bold faces of some people. Miss Price, in rejoinder, congratulated herself upon not being possessed of the envious feeling of other people, whereupon Miss Squeers made some general remark touching the danger of associating with low persons, in which Miss Price entirely coincided, observing that it was very true indeed, and she had thought so for a very long time.
"Tilda," exclaimed Miss Squeers with dignity, "I hate you."
"Ah, there's no love lost between us, I assure you," said Miss Price, tying her bonnet strings with a jerk. "You'll cry your eyes out when I'm gone. You know you will."
"I scorn your words, minx," said Miss Squeers.
"You pay me a great compliment when you say so," answered the miller's daughter, courteousing very low. "Wish you a very good night, ma'am, and pleasant dreams attend your sleep."
With this parting benediction, Miss Price swept from the room, followed by the huge Yorkshireman, who exchanged with Nicholas at parting that peculiarly expressive scowl with which the cut and thrust counts in melodramatic performances, to inform each other they will meet again. They were no sooner gone than Miss Squeers fulfilled the prediction of her quondam friend by giving vent to the most copious burst of tears and uttering various dismal lamentations and incoherent words. Nicholas stood looking on for a few seconds, rather doubtful what to do, but feeling uncertain whether the fit would end in his being embraced or scratched, and considering that either infliction would be equally agreeable, he walked off very quietly while Miss Squeers was moaning into her pocket handkerchief.
"This is one consequence," thought Nicholas when he had groped his way to the dark sleeping room, "of my cursed readiness to adapt myself to any society in which chance carries me. If I had sat mute and motionless, as I might have done, this would not have happened." He listened for a few minutes, but all was quiet.
"I was glad," he murmured, "to grasp at any relief from the sight of this dreadful place, or the presence of its vile master. I have set these people by the ears and made two new enemies, where heaven knows I needed none. Well, it is a just punishment for having forgotten, even for an hour, what is around me now." So saying, he felt his way among the throng of weary-hearted sleepers, and he crept into his poor bed. How Mr. Ralph Nickleby, Chapter 10, provided for his niece and sister-in-law. On the second morning after the departure of Nicholas for Yorkshire, Kate Nickleby sat in a very faded chair, raised upon a very dusty throne, in Miss La Creevy's room, giving that lady a sitting for the portrait upon which she was engaged,
and towards the full perfection of which Miss La Creevy had had the street door case brought upstairs in order that she might be better able to infuse into the counterfeit countenance of Miss Nickleby a bright salmon flesh tint which she had originally hit upon while executing the miniature of a young officer the rain created, and which bright salmon flesh tint was considered by Miss La Creevy's chief friends and patrons to be quite a novelty in art, as indeed it was.
"I think I've caught it now," said Miss La Creevy. "The very shade! Oh, this will be the sweetest portrait I've ever done, most certainly."
"It will be your genius that makes it so, then, I'm sure," replied Kate, smiling. No, I won't allow that, my dear," rejoined Miss La Creevy. "It's a very nice subject, a very nice subject indeed, though, of course, something depends upon the mode of treatment." "And not a little," observed Kate. "Why, my dear, you are right there," said Miss La Creevy. "In the main you are right there, though I don't allow that it is of such very great importance in the present case. Ah, the difficulties of art, my dear, they are great."
"They must be, I have no doubt," said Kate, honouring her good-natured little friend.
"They are beyond anything you can form the faintest conception of," replied Miss La Creevy. "What, with bringing out eyes with all one's power, and keeping down noses with all one's force, and adding to heads and taking away teeth altogether, you have no idea of the trouble one little miniature is."
"The remuneration can scarcely repay you," said Kate.
"Why, it does not. And that's the truth," answered Miss La Creevy. "And then people are so dissatisfied and unreasonable that 9 times out of 10 there's no pleasure in painting them. Sometimes they say, 'Oh, how very serious you have made me look, Miss La Creevy,' and at others, 'La, Miss La Creevy, how very smirking,' when the very essence of a good portrait is that it must be either serious or smirking, or it's no portrait at all."
"Indeed," said Kate, laughing.
"Certainly, my dear, because the sitters are always either the one or the other," replied Miss La Creevy. "Look at the Royal Academy. All those beautiful, shiny portraits of gentlemen in black velvet waistcoats, with their fists doubled up on round tables, or marble slabs, are serious, you know, and all the ladies who are playing with little parasols or little dogs or little children. It's the same rule in art, only varying the objects, are smirking. In fact," said Miss La Creevy, sinking her voice to a confidential whisper, "there are only 2 styles of portrait painting, the serious and the smirk, and we always use the serious for professional people, except actors sometimes, and the smirk for private ladies and gentlemen who don't care much about looking clever." Kate seemed highly amused by this information, and Miss La Creevy went on painting and talking with immovable complacency.
"What a number of officers you seem to paint," said Kate, availing herself of a pause in the discourse and glancing round the room.
"Number of what, child?" inquired Miss La Creevy, looking up from her work. "Oh, character portrait. Oh, yes. Oh, they're not real military men, you know."
"No.
Oh, bless your heart, of course not. Only clerks and that, you know. They hire a uniform coat to be painted in and send it here in a carpet bag."
"Some artists," said Miss La Creevy, "keep a red coat and charge 7 and 6 pence extra for hire and carmen. But I don't do that myself, for I don't consider it legitimate."
Drawing herself up as though she plumed herself greatly upon not resorting to these lures to catch sitters, Miss La Creevy applied herself more intently to her task, only raising her head occasionally to look with unspeakable satisfaction at some touch she had just put in, and now and then giving Miss Nickleby to understand what particular features she was at work upon at the moment. "Not," she expressly observed, "that you should make it up for painting, my dear, but because it's our custom sometimes to tell sitters what part we are upon, in order that if there's any particular expression they want introduced, they may throw it in at the time, you know."
"And when," said Miss La Creevy after a long silence, to wit, an interval of 1.5 minutes, "when do you expect to see your uncle again?"
"I scarcely know. I'd expected to have seen him before now," replied Kate.
"Soon, I hope, for this state of uncertainty is worse than anything."
"I suppose he has money, hasn't he?" inquired Miss La Creevy.
"He's very rich, I have heard," rejoined Kate. "I don't know what he is, but I believe so."
"Ah, you may depend upon it he is, or he wouldn't be so surly," remarked Miss La Creevy, who was an old, odd mixture of shrewdness and simplicity. When a man's a bear, he is generally pretty independent. His manner is rough, said Kate.
Rough, cried Miss La Creevy. A porcupine's a feathered bed to him. I never met with such a cross-grained old savage.
It's only his manner, I believe, observed Kate timidly. He was disappointed in early life, and I think I've heard or has had his temper soured by some calamity. I should be sorry to think ill of him until I knew he deserved it.
Well, that's very right and proper, observed the miniature painter, and heaven forbid that I should be the cause of your doing so. But now mightn't he, without feeling it himself, make you and your mamma some nice little allowance that would keep you both comfortable until you were well married and be a little fortune to her afterwards? What would 100 a year, for instance, be to him?
I don't know what it would be to him, said Kate with energy, but it would be that to me. I would rather die than take it.
Heyday, cried Miss La Creevy. A dependence upon him, said Kate, would embitter my whole life. I should feel begging a far less degradation.
Well, exclaimed Miss La Creevy, this is of a relation whom you will not hear an indifferent person speak ill of, my dear. It sounds oddly enough, I confess.
I dare say it does, replied Kate, speaking more gently. Indeed, I am sure it must. I only mean that, with the feelings and recollection of better times upon me, I could not bear to live on anybody's bounty, not his particularly, but anybody's.
Miss La Creevy looked slyly at her companion, as if she doubted whether Ralph himself were not the subject of dislike, but seeing that her young friend was distressed, made no remark.
I only ask of him, continued Kate, whose tears fell while she spoke, that he will move so little out of his way in my behalf as to enable me by his recommendation, only with his recommendation, to earn literally my bread and remain with my mother. Whether we shall ever taste happiness again depends upon the fortunes of my dear brother, but if he will do this, and Nicholas only tells us that he is well and cheerful, then I will be content.
As she ceased to speak, there was a rustling behind the screen, which stood between her and the door, and some person knocked at the wainscot.
"Come in, whoever it is," cried Miss La Creevy.
The person complied, and coming forward at once gave to view the form and features of no less an individual than Mr. Ralph Nickleby himself.
"Your servant, ladies," said Ralph, looking sharply at them by turns. "You were talking so loud that I was unable to make you hear."
When the man of business had a more than commonly vicious snarl lurking at his heart, he had a trick of almost concealing his eyes under their thick and protruding brows for an instant, and then displaying them in their full keenness. As he did so now, and tried to keep down the smile which parted his thin, compressed lips, and puckered up the bad lines about his mouth, they both felt certain that some part, if not the whole, of their recent conversation had been overheard.
"I called in on my way upstairs, more than half expecting to find you here," said Ralph, addressing his niece and looking contemptuously at the portrait. "Is that my niece's portrait, ma'am?"
Yes, it is, Mr. Nickleby," said Miss La Creevy with a very sprightly air. "And between you and me and the post, sir, it will be a very nice portrait too, though I say it, who am the painter."
"Don't trouble yourself to show it to me, ma'am," cried Ralph, moving away. "I have no eye for likenesses. Is it nearly finished?"
Why, yes, replied Miss La Creevy, considering with the pencil end of her brush in her mouth. "Two sittings more will—"
"Well, have them at once, ma'am," said Ralph. "She'll have no time to idle over fooleries after tomorrow. Work, ma'am, work. We must all work. Have you let your lodgings, ma'am?"
I've not put the bill up yet, sir.
"Well, put it up at once, ma'am. They won't want the rooms after this week, or if they do, they can't pay for them. Now, my dear, if you're ready, we'll lose no more time."
With an assumption of kindness which sat worse upon him, even than his usual manner, Mr. Ralph Nickleby motioned to the young lady to precede him, and, bowing gravely to Miss La Creevy, closed the door and followed up the stairs, where Mrs. Nickleby received him with many expressions of regard. Stopping them, somewhat abruptly, Ralph waved his hand with an impatient gesture and proceeded to the object of his visit.
I've found a situation for your daughter, ma'am, said Ralph.
Well, replied Mrs. Nickleby, I will say that it's only just what I have expected of you. Depend upon it, I said to Kate only yesterday morning at breakfast, that after your uncle has provided in the most ready manner for Nicholas, he will not leave us until he has done at least the same for you. These were my very words, as near as I remember. Kate, my dear, why don't you think of...
Let me proceed, ma'am, pray,
said Ralph, interrupting his sister-in-law in the full torrent of a discourse. Kate, my love, let your uncle proceed, said Mrs. Nickleby.
I am most anxious that he should, ma'am, rejoined Kate. Well, my dear, if you are anxious that he should, you had better allow your uncle to say what he has to say, without interruption,
observed Mrs. Nickleby with many small nods and frowns. Your uncle's time is very valuable, my dear, and however desirous you may be, and naturally desirous as I am sure any affectionate relations who have been so little of your, seen so little of your uncle as we have, must naturally be to protract the pleasure of having him among us, still we are bound not to be selfish, but to take into consideration the important nature of his occupations in the city.
I'm very much obliged to you, ma'am, said Ralph,
with a scarcely perceptible sneer.
An absence of business habits in this family leads apparently to a great waste of words before business, when it does come under consideration, is arrived at all.
I fear it is so indeed, replied Mrs. Nickleby with a sigh. Your poor brother...
My poor brother, ma'am, interposed Ralph tartly, had no idea what business was. Was unacquainted, I verily believe, with the very meaning of the word.
I fear he was, said Mrs. Nickleby with her handkerchief to her eyes. If it hadn't been for me, I don't know what would have become of him. What strange creatures we are. The slight bait so skilfully thrown out by Ralph on their first interview was dangling on the hook yet. At every small deprivation or discomfort which presented itself in the course of the 24 hours to remind her of her straitened and altered circumstances, peevish visions of her dower of £1,000 had arisen before Mrs. Nickleby's mind, until, at last, she had come to persuade herself that all her late husband's creditors, she was the worst used and the most to be pitied. And yet she had loved him dearly for many years, and had no greater share of selfishness than is the usual lot of mortals. Such is the irritability of sudden poverty. A decent annuity would have restored her thoughts to their old train at once. Well, that's Nicholas Nickleby for today. I hope you've had a lovely Easter, as I said at the start, and that, they're predicting rain for tomorrow, so we'll have to wait and see what actually happens. But we've had some beautiful days in Braidwood. So take care. I'll be back next Monday and with a further instalment of Nicholas Nickleby by Charles Dickens. Until then, keep safe, keep happy.